headlines this hour. Lebanon's new Prime Minister-designate Najib Mikati begins consultations with leading political parties in a bid to form a long-awaited government. The United Kingdom rejects the European Union's overtures regarding Northern Ireland, insisting that the Brexit agreement must be renegotiated. And Australia's New South Wales faces an extension of coronavirus-related restrictions as its daily new cases spike to a 16-month peak. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. In Lebanon, Najib Mikati is set to begin his bid to form a government one day after he was designated as the new prime minister. Mikati is due to hold consultations with leading political parties in an attempt to form the long-awaited government. That marks the third such attempt by a politician in a year. Last week, Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri failed to form a cabinet and stepped down. He cited differences with President Michel Aoun. Lebanon has been run by a caretaker administration since August of last year. That is when the government resigned in the aftermath of a devastating explosion in the Beirut port. The political vacuum has fueled Lebanon's financial crisis. Mikati has pledged reforms and transparency. U.S. President Joe Biden and Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kazemi have reached an agreement on formally ending the presence of American combat forces in the Arab country by the end of 2021.
I think things are going well. Our role in Iraq will be as a dealing with not, it's just to be available to continue to train, to assist, to help, and to deal with ISIS as it arrives. But we are not going to be by the end of the year in a combat mission.
The announcement was made during the first face-to-face meeting between Biden and Kazemi at the White House as part of a strategic dialogue between the two leaders. Biden said, however, that the U.S. counterterrorism operation will continue, even after shifting to a new phase. The Iraqi resistance groups, however, have time and again stressed that all American troops must leave the country. The U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003 over allegations of possessing weapons of mass destruction by then-Iraqi ruler Saddam Hussein, but such weapons were never found. Washington redeployed its troops to the Arab country years later under the pretext of fighting the Daesh terror group. Political commentator Scott Bennett says the fact that some U.S. troops are allowed to stay in Iraq is because of the lobbying and interests of the U.S. military-industrial complex, as well as Israeli intelligence services.
It's only in the interest of the military-industrial complex, the mercenaries, the Mossad, the professionals that make bombs and bullets and missiles, and this is precisely why they're trying to stay there. They're trying to keep a foothold in Iraq. But I think the Iraqi people have spoken up. The Iraqi people have said, we do not want American mercenaries in our country. And I think they also recognize this is a failed terror attempt that started in 2001 under the great false flag events of 9/11, where the U.S. thought that it could expand its military hold on places like Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, Iraq, and with ultimate ambitions on Iran. So they may have still be suffering under this delusion that they can maintain troops in Iraq for operations against Iran. But I think even that is very quickly dimming. We're witnessing that the world has woken up. They're rejecting the Western imperial presence.
Prominent Shia Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has hailed a deal between Baghdad and Washington for the withdrawal of American combat forces from Iraq. Saad says that he is waiting for a complete pullout of U.S. troops, echoing calls by the Iraqi resistance factions for a full exit. The cleric has also thanked the Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kazemi for his efforts to strike the agreement. Kazemi on Monday met U.S. President Joe Biden in Washington. The two agreed on formally ending the U.S. combat mission by the end of the year. Iraq's al-Nujaba resistance movement has also called for a complete pullout. The movement has insisted that a new deal must include the departure of the U.S. military's Air Force. It's time now for a news review of this bulletin. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has called for the renegotiation of the post-Brexit trade deal between London and the European Union. Johnson has rejected EU offers to resolve disagreements over post-Brexit arrangements for Northern Ireland. He said the offers are insufficient. Johnson has insisted that comprehensive and durable solutions are needed to address the existing problems. London wants key changes in the trade deal that it signed with Brussels last year in the wake of its departure from the bloc. Northern Ireland is a hot issue as it, in effect, stays in the EU's single market. The UK says the issues will be settled only if its demands are met. From Brussels, our correspondent Jerome Hughes joins us. We also have Amina Taylor, a correspondent, joining us from London. Okay, let's first cross on over to London. Amina Taylor, what Johnson has said, I'm guessing there's some provisions within the agreement that says that you can't make a deal and then break it. But tell us more about what the major, obviously, disagreements are, what he views it to be the major sticking points that he wants to renegotiate a deal here.
Well, that's a very good question you ask, Calvin. Jerome in Brussels can add some more light on that particular issue. Because what I'm desperately trying to scratch my head here is what has changed since 2019 that now makes something that both sides agreed on in good faith suddenly a situation where Britain is saying it's only going to be sorted if the European Commission kind of bends to Westminster's will. So I'm desperately trying to think about what is involved in what was already a kind of patchwork agreement that kicked some of those serious issues into the long grass. And now we're essentially seeing a prime minister that's having a lot of tension, a lot of issues from once loyal supporters in the north of Ireland who are saying to him, hey, this isn't working for us. It's not working in terms of economics. It's not working in terms of identity. And what better way to play that than to say, well, this actually is the fault of Brussels, and it's not because we signed a poor deal that we no longer want to stick with. I'm a little bit confused here, and I think the real losers here may well be the people in the north of Ireland, because I can't understand how Britain can, in good faith, say it wants an entire renegotiation of something it signed off on.
So is that the real issue only, you think, north of Ireland? And Jerome, in the bigger picture, is there a possibility that Johnson, I mean, some are saying that there is a possibility that Prime Minister Boris Johnson just wanted to get this over with, in a sense, enough talks, and he signed up on it, and now we're seeing things boiling up to the surface, if that is something that maybe you can elaborate on for us.
That's right, Cathy, and I think you've hit the nail on the head there. There's a feeling here when you speak to senior people inside the European Commission off the record, they say, you know, that basically Boris Johnson is playing political games, that he just wanted to get a deal over the line and then down the road renegotiate things, and that's what we're seeing. I mean, the European Commission in the past 24 hours has put forward proposals that would allow UK regulators to give the green light for medicines moving from Britain into Northern Ireland, but apparently it doesn't include drugs relating to cancer. And the UK side is saying, look, these proposals are welcome, you know, they're being put forward, but they just don't go far enough. And they're looking for a renegotiation, a completely new Northern Ireland protocol, which goes against international law, because both sides signed up on this. And so, you know, there's a broader picture here as well in terms of the overall long-term fallout from this. What about the trust between the EU and the British government? There's a feeling here that Boris Johnson is completely untrustworthy and that his government is untrustworthy, and that we hear the signals from the UK negotiator David Frost and the type of language he uses. And so there's a long-term implications here beyond just, you know, the situation in Northern Ireland, but actual relations between the EU and the UK. And the other deeper issue here is relating to tensions in Northern Ireland. I mean, the media is very careful how it reports on things in Northern Ireland because it doesn't want to stoke tensions further. But there's no doubt that tensions are there. I mean, it might just be, you know, sectarian graffiti. Loyalists are very unhappy. Unionists are very unhappy. So it might be just small skirmishes and that type of thing that generally goes unreported. But the problem is those tensions are growing. So what happens a few months down the line? The unionists feel betrayed by Boris Johnson as well. And therefore, we have a situation that, you know, we could have a trade sanction, so potentially a trade war between the EU and the UK. That's one case scenario. But the worst case scenario would be a deterioration with the situation in Northern Ireland and potential violence and so on. And the EU side is saying the Northern Ireland Protocol is designed to prevent that, because it doesn't have, it means there's no hard border on the island of Ireland, and therefore, you know, peace, the Northern Ireland, the Good Friday Agreement is preserved. So it just, we have to see how it pans out, but relations really are at an all-time low between the EU and the UK.
Well, I know there's so many questions here that we can't obviously address, I mean, in the time frame that we have, but it sounds like this is going to drag on. I mean, it doesn't sound like this is going to be something where there's going to be some kind of quick fix in terms of a resolution from either side. What is the government exactly saying at this point as to where this is going to go?
Well, essentially, they're saying there's one game in town, and it's the Westminster game. And something that Jerome touched on a little bit there, let me just quickly elaborate. The idea here that Johnson is a bad faith actor and his government just pretty much wanted to get this done, the pledge they ran on in the elections in 2019 was get Brexit done. And that he did. What they didn't say was, we're going to make sure the fine print is okay. And do remember, this was just before COVID. So now we're dealing with a post-COVID reality in a post-COVID economic landscape. And unfortunately, the stats, the economic repercussions of all of that just has not been as planned. I mean, no one could have foreseen the COVID crisis, but I don't think Brexit has aided and bettered that in any respect. So we're looking at a government, in my humble opinion, that's really gasping and grasping for some villains, people to blame in some of these instances. And what better trumped up enemy than to maybe stick the EU with the bus on this occasion?
Okay, thank you so much. That's Amina Tilley, a correspondent, talking to us from London. Jerome Hughes, nice to see you, a correspondent there from Brussels. And with that, we come to an end of this news review. Welcome back. The U.S. Defense Secretary has expressed deep concern over the alarming spike in suicides among American forces. Lloyd Austin said the Pentagon is working hard to tackle the problem, and there is still a lot to do. Last year, 385 active-duty American soldiers died by suicide. That made a steep increase from the 326 cases reported by the Pentagon in 2018. According to the U.S. Defense Department, stress factors for troops include the unpredictability of life in the military. Case in point, troops stationed in Alaska encounter harsh weather conditions. They face geographic and social isolation, as well as frequent training and deployment. Soldiers also face high cost of living, prevalent alcohol abuse, and sleep disorders. Australia's most populous state of New South Wales faces an extension of coronavirus-related restrictions after new cases surged to a 16-month high. New South Wales reported 172 new infections Tuesday. That is up from 145 cases one day earlier. In response, the local government said that the 5-week lockdown of the state could be further extended. A final decision is expected later this week. More than half of Australia's nearly 26 million population has been under a lockdown in recent weeks. It followed an outbreak of the highly infectious Delta variant in New South Wales' capital, Sydney, and has spread to three other states. Australia has so far recorded over 33,000 COVID cases and 920 deaths from the pandemic. Thousands of people from across the world are taking to the streets to protest against anti-COVID measures as governments have ramped up pressure on the unvaccinated. Mandating health passes and COVID-19 jabs in Europe has fueled public anger as people believe such policies curtail freedom.
Tens of thousands of people in France, the UK, Italy, and Greece protested against coronavirus restrictions and mandatory vaccination policies, sparking clashes with police forces. The European governments tried to force more unvaccinated people to receive their coronavirus shots by using sanctions. In France, nearly 160,000 people held nationwide protests against the implementation of a health pass by President Emmanuel Macron's government. Demonstrators slammed this policy by saying it's an attack on their liberty. Macron's health pass will ban access to restaurants and public spaces for unvaccinated people. During the rallies, tensions flared up as French anti-riot police fired tear gas toward protesters and used water cannons to disperse them. Several demonstrators have also been arrested, Elsewhere in Europe, thousands of Italians took to the streets of Rome, Naples, and Turin against the government's introduction of restrictions on unvaccinated people. Protesters chanted slogans such as "Freedom" and "Down with the dictatorship" over plans for a government certificate known as the Green Pass. The Green Pass is an extension of the EU's digital COVID certificate and will be required from August 6th to enter cinemas, museums, indoor swimming pools or sports stadiums, or eat indoors at restaurants. Thousands of people have also protested in London against what they describe as an erosion of their civil liberties. Demonstrators denounced the UK government's track and trace app, saying it limits their movements. Over 600,000 people are told to self-isolate in 1 week alone this month. The protests come a week after most coronavirus restrictions in England were lifted. Police used tear gas and water cannon to disperse more than 4,000 people who had gathered in central Athens to protest against mandatory COVID-19 vaccinations. Police sources claim that some protesters had thrown petrol bombs, prompting the police to respond with tear gas.
Certainly the lockdowns are making people unhappy. They're driving up unemployment. They're adding to general restlessness. But the problem is broader. I mean, I think people are upset about the poor economy, which is and slow economic growth, which is now in its 13th or 14th year.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review. and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Two Blue Lines, directed by Tom Hayes. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian and The Telegraph. And beside him, we are also joined by Professor Jonathan Rosenhead from the London School of Economics. He is also vice chair of Free Speech on Israel, a non-Zionist Jewish organization that believes anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. Now, filmed over 25 years, Two Blue Lines explores the impact of Israeli settlement on the Palestinians from before the creation of Israel to the present day, and not afraid to explore correlations between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine, what emerges is a picture of a desperate social and political struggle punctuated by violence, segregation, and racism. By primarily featuring the narratives of Israelis whose positions run counter to Israel's official policy, this documentary also provides a portrait of the ongoing conflict not often depicted in the mainstream media.
You cannot come into an area where other people are living, establish a state, confiscate their lands, and expect to live in safety. And that's what happened. They came in, conquered, and confiscated.
In these camps of misery lived the scores of thousands whose native land was for centuries Palestine.
We took land that in the Bible maybe is ours, but it definitely wasn't empty. There are people living here. This is their land.
This is ours, in every sense of the word.
From a distance, this Jewish colony in Palestine looks as romantic as a Dutch picture. Close to, it's different. The guards are Jewish colonists armed with shotguns.
It's immoral what they do with religion, to my mind. And it's not Jewish. It's un-Jewish.
This is the acid test. This is the reality test. All these values that we've held for all these generations.
If people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet.
There is a way leading from humanity through nationality to bestiality.
First of all, a very warm welcome to you. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary tackles a controversial subject and isn't shy to portray Israel in a negative light and even interviews Israelis themselves who are against Israel's policies against the Palestinians and their treatment. Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
I think it's a little bit patchwork and piecemeal, and that's in part because of the way that this film was produced over the course of 25 years. So there is a sense of a director sort of going back to material and just stitching it together where he can. I think it has moments of real power, and as you say, it does have this new perspective on these events, and I think one of the challenges this conflict has presented to filmmakers is to try and find fresh angles, fresh ways into the conflict that aren't just restating the same old positions time and time and again. And this does find two or three new angles into this conflict that I thought were particularly revealing. Mm-hmm.
And what are some of those angles that you briefly mentioned?
Well, I mean, getting Israelis to talk about this conflict, and particularly recruiting very calmly spoken, very sympathetic Israelis who have been given at the very least cause to doubt what their rulers have been doing over the past 50 years in particular, mm-hmm. and often are openly critical of official state policy. It is obviously a very, very tricky subject, but here there is a sense of filmmaker really going a little bit deeper and finding out that there are little pockets of room to maneuver, room for negotiation.
It was very refreshing to see.
Yeah, very much so.
Jonathan, if I can turn to you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, it's very much not a neutral film. It is objective in that it describes quite calmly some very disturbing things. It represents, perhaps not quite proportionally, it represents the views of some of the settlers who are, if you like, the beneficiaries and the perpetrators of many of the wrongs. It does so in order to reveal the inconsistencies in their position and their assumptions, and some of which I think Jews would find extremely repugnant. But so that when one of the settlers says, "Oh, it's there's violence on both sides. I was shot at once. I was shot at in my car with a machine gun," and then he's asked later on, "Why do you live with your children in this dangerous area?" He said, "Oh, it only happened to once." But for Palestinians, it happens every day, not actually being shot at, but they are subjugated, humiliated, prevented from going about their daily life, etc. And that is shown very vividly.
We do indeed get a spectrum of opinion and views on this documentary.
The whole world sees the immorality of our of what we're doing and of what we've been doing since we've been occupying the West Bank for 22 years. For two decades, the world didn't see it because the Palestinians seemed willing to live under Israeli rule. That is, they didn't revolt. The children who grew up in that period, seeing their parents bending their heads under Israeli occupation, said to themselves, "When I grow up, I'm not going to put up with this."
It was really interesting to see that Israeli author age over the course of this documentary. But I just want to address a point he made. Jonathan, he says that the Palestinians seemed willing, or the older generation, to live under Israeli rule. Surely that can't be right.
I was in Israel in 1956 as a visitor. I visited it not at all for the next 40 years. I don't know, I can't say from first hand what it was, but one can imagine the trauma of this total dispossession. 80% of the Palestinians were forced out. Those that were left often had their villages and their homes destroyed. So one can well imagine that it took time to recover from that. Mm-hmm. And I think the younger generation, which grew up under those circumstances, was then more resilient and said, we don't want to live like this for the rest of our lives. Now, of course, the fact is they have had to live like that for the rest of their lives, and it's getting worse.
And definitely in this film you see this resurgence and this uprising, especially among the youths. And Mike, do you have any thoughts on what Jonathan just said and how the portrayal of the resistance is shown?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly one of the advantages this film has is that it is shot over 25 years. So you do get a sense of not just how long this conflict is going on, but how positions are shifting, how people's perspectives are changing in the course of that quarter century. I do think you get a sense that people are becoming more and more aware that actually for a long time the only way out of this conflict has been death. And I think people are starting to look for avenues, ways out, and to communicate their position in a way that isn't necessarily violent. And all that comes through in the course of the film.
Mm-hmm. Of course, in the documentary you also see lots of statistics. It's filmed over 25 years, many historical events that happened during that time. And I just want to touch on a few statistics that the documentary raises, particularly about Palestinian children fatalities in comparison to Israeli casualties. And you can see the difference is stark. So according to the documentary, child fatalities between 2000 and 2014 of Israeli children was something like 133, whereas over 1,400 Palestinian kids were killed by the Israeli side. Does this show then that this is indeed an unequal war?
It's not really a war at all, because it's not a war. A war, you have to have two sides. Here you have basically one side, which can punish the other side at will. Now, I think the suicide bombing was both immoral and it was counterproductive for the Palestinians. So I'm not trying to defend that. But it was a relatively short period when it was realized it was actually reinforcing the tendencies to repression of the Israeli state. So that was cancelled, and I think that is completely right. But people in this country pay attention when Israel is attacking Gaza, and quite a lot of people would know that 2,000 people were killed, more than 2,000 were killed in the last assault in 2014. What they don't realize is that this happens on a small but regular scale every day of the week, and that the numbers killed of Palestinians now in excess of 10,000, so that the assaults on Gaza are less than half of the total of deaths, and that is the price of Israel repressing the Palestinians.
And Mike, do you think that this documentary then portrays the conflict as an unequal conflict, and serves as a good introduction to people who are unaware of what is happening?
Yes, certainly, because it is talking to people on the ground. It is talking to people, you know, who are caught up in this conflict, either on one side or the other. So it shows you the way the travel system has been converted in a particular way, so that Israelis are allowed to travel on certain roads, Palestinians aren't. Certain roads are blocked off, walled off. The level of control extends to something like the water supply, and there's a lot of talk in this film about, you know, some people are going without water, other people have enough water to fill a swimming pool.
The settlements have swimming,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so what you get in the course of the film is a sense of the level of control that's being imposed over every single aspect of life. And you know, to see that is very stark.
It is far-reaching and multifaceted.
The minimum service that the municipality have to give to the people is to take the garbage, to collect the garbage. I don't talk about the roads. You can see the road. I don't talk about the lights. I don't talk about school services and water services. Even water, people, the municipality didn't give them. The municipality said...
No bees at all. There is no bees at all.
This is all done on purpose. Nothing of the occupation happens by chance. No. It happens on purpose. It happens in order to make the Palestinians' life a hell.
We have dehumanized the enemy, as we have been dehumanized only a short time ago. We call them Hayadu-Waglut, a two-legged animal. We are reenacting without being able to control it. We are reenacting what happened to us as if we've never learned anything.
Very powerful words there. Jonathan, I just wanted to get a quick reaction from you for that woman, what she just said, and drawing comparisons between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine.
Yes, well, that in Britain, where we're speaking from, has become a big issue, because there's been an attempt to police what you're allowed to say about Israel or Palestine. If you make any such comparison, there will be a whole gang of people on the phone to the papers or the government saying that this is anti-Semitism because you're drawing parallels. But of course we have to draw parallels with those events in history which speak to people. That's our way of making sense of what's happening now. It's not to say that it is the same, it's different, its scale is completely different. The intention is not to annihilate a whole race, but the intention is to demolish a nation, which is slightly different, with all of its identifying characteristics, and to steal its land. And one has to be able to make those parallels, just as one makes the parallels with South African apartheid, which is, I think, in this documentary, is absolutely starkly evident that it's apartheid in Israel.
And Mike, we were just talking before we went to the clip, actually, about how this documentary portrays how Palestinians are being dehumanized in every aspect of this control system. What other scenes from the film struck out the most to you?
Well, I mean, one of the things this film did was introduce me to a number of the groups who are working within the Middle East to try and resolve this conflict peacefully. So, you know, groups like Blockade Watch and Peace Block, the Women in Black, who are, I think, wives and mothers and daughters who are on the Israeli side, who come out to mourn the losses of you know, all the children killed in the conflict. So there is a sense of people on the ground starting to realize the extent to which this conflict has cost them personally. And, you know, the scenes of mourning are very, very powerful.
And speaking of Israeli settlements, this documentary goes into detail about that and interviews settlers themselves, who we can see are quite vicious in their treatment to the Palestinians. Now, according to reports, around 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 illegal settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds, which is in violation of international law and the United Nations Security Council resolutions. And this documentary does a good job of showing various UN resolutions that are being violated. Why then is the UN so powerless against Israel?
Oh, well, that's very clear. The UN is unable to to pass resolutions which would have teeth, that is to say, which would impose sanctions on Israel without the agreement of all the powers with vetoes at the Security Council. And the United States has vetoed over 40 such resolutions over time. Often it's been the only country in the Security Council voting against a resolution. So it ensures that the so-called international community is absolutely toothless. And countries like Britain or the European Union regularly pass resolutions in Parliament saying we deplore this, we don't like that. They do nothing because they are unwilling to separate themselves from this very strong United States position. So the whole international community mouths pious words, except perhaps the United States doesn't do it so much, and does nothing. And therefore it's up to the Palestinians themselves who have to endure, and the international civic society which has to adopt boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Well, boycott is what we can do as individuals, as a means of supporting and putting pressure on the Israelis to come to the table and make the concessions necessary for peace.
This village cannot have electricity. There are electric wires that an NGO put in, but the Israeli military will not allow them to hook up to the electric grid. If you can imagine that kind of racism. I believe if people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet. You know, I've seen the most heinous crimes committed against Palestinians, and my Israeli friends would stand with me in saying the same thing.
The fact that there are Americans who are tolerating in Israel what they would not tolerate in the United States itself, and American Jews who accept that Israel behave in a way which they would very much object to people behave in the United States itself is very bad for Israel.
And Mike, what did you make of this part of the documentary? Was this another refreshing angle to see on this conflict?
Certainly. I mean, it's telling that actually the production company responsible is called Journeyman Films, because either this is the work of an American director, a veteran American director, probably wasn't quite as veteran when he first started shooting all this and than when he came out of it. But it is, I think, clearly the work of an American director possessed of a conscience enough to want to bring this conflict back home to America and to show the American people exactly what's going on in this particular part of the world. And it does a very good job of defining this very complex relationship between the US and Israel as we go into the final half hour of the film.
And Jonathan, this film confronts American viewers with a sort of Israeli schism over the country's oppression of Palestine, as well as the US government's responsibility. The documentary says that over $100 billion of taxpayers' money have been spent to Israel, the most than any other country in the world. And the majority of the Security Council vetoes have supported Israel's wars. Do you think this documentary will serve as a wake-up call then to Western audiences?
But that very much depends on how widely it gets viewed. And there is a very elaborate and expensive and effective campaign run by the Ministry of Strategic Affairs in Israel to try and blanket the world with propaganda favorable to Israel. And we have, of course, our own domestic in Britain, Israel Lobby, which was shown in a recent documentary. We have the very powerful Israel Lobby in the United States. And the media is very nearly impermeable to these sorts of arguments generally. And that the campaign to persuade people that even relatively mild criticism of Israel is probably motivated by anti-Semitism is started in Israel and has been pumped out around the world. And I think the reason is they don't want this message to get out. Now, whether this movie can make it, this documentary can make it, I very much hope so. And if so, it will have a powerful effect.
Actually, a point you just made, the documentary mentions about the media and how these Israelis are always portrayed as the victims, whereas the Palestinians are the aggressors, when actually it's the reverse situation.
Yeah.
How responsible does the media, what role do they play in pushing this narrative?
Well, I think they are susceptible to it. And there is a battle going on about language, how you describe things. It's, as Alice said in Alice in Wonderland, it's when Alice says to Humpty Dumpty, you can't use that word, make it mean anything you like, and Humpty Dumpty says, the question is, who's to be master, that's all. Mm-hmm. And if you can control the language by which something is described, you control the perceptions. And I think that attempt is going on. We have to fight for the right to describe it as it is.
And Mike, would you agree with what Jonathan said? Do you think this documentary will serve as a wake-up call also for Western audiences?
Well, hopefully. I mean, you know, it's getting a pretty small distribution. It's being independently distributed online. It doesn't have necessarily the cinematic heft that we've seen films like Waltz with Bashir and The Gatekeepers, the documentary from a couple of years back, that were all about Israeli people talking about the failings of the Israeli authorities. So it doesn't quite have that cinematic heft. But, you know, if you can find it out, like I say, it does have some really powerful moments.
And if I could just, we're coming to the end of the programme now, if I could get your final thoughts on the documentary and if you'd recommend it.
Oh, it's certainly, you know, this situation is so tricky that, you know, any new perspective that people can find on it, it is worth seeking out for that reason.
And Jonathan, can I get your final thoughts on the film also?
Very striking how little has changed except insofar it's intensified and got worse. You see the interviews and you're not sure necessarily whether it was done in 1989, 1999, 2009. This is a continuing story, and we have failed, and we have to do better.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid we've run out of time on Doc Review. And that's it for this episode of the show. Thank you to both my guests, and to you. Don't forget to leave your comments and your thoughts. I've been Camelia Shambayati.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
سيد عبد الله الموسوي.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. In a previous episode, I started looking at the convention or a seminar that was held in 1998 in Tehran in Iran concerning human rights. And the only reason I'm looking at that because it still talks about events and talks about things that are current to our times, even though it is over 20 years ago that was held. But the topics themselves, they are still very fresh. That's why I said, you know what, let's look at it and let's just keep it in mind. Amongst things that was mentioned in this seminar or this convention, or call it what you like, the doctors and the experts in the panel, they did agree that the human rights charter that was made by the United Nations, it's in fact a result of the oppression of nations. So you have a lot of nations who are oppressed, and the result of this oppression gave us this charter of a human right. However, this human rights that was given to us, it was meant to fight oppression and fight oppressors, wherever they might be. And most of them, if not all of them, 30-something sections of this charter, they all stem from Islamic teachings, or we find an Islamic teachings that backs them up, nevertheless. But such charter, even though it is there, even though the United Nations themselves are the ones who are upholding and are trying to enforce it, yet we see they lack when it comes to which countries should they apply it to. Because the United Nations itself is made from different nations. And among the nations that are part of the United Nations, there are superpowers. These superpowers, they use this charter for their best interest. I'll give you an example. So, obviously, wars and initiating wars and taking the lands of other, usurping the land of other people, killing other people, bombing other people, and stuff like that, it is not allowed and forbidden under the Constitution of the United Nations and in the Human Rights Charter. Yet, we get to see that when in Palestine in 2021, when Israel started bombing the Palestinians in Gaza, when a lot of people and a lot of nations and even the United Nations themselves, they wanted to start a meeting, like an emergency meeting, to, you know, put an end to the war or to the fighting that's happening, and to put at least a guideline for a ceasefire. You see that America denied and said such meeting should not take place, and we will not allow such a gathering, such a meeting to take place. Why? Because America itself was influenced by Israel that we need more time to accomplish our mission, meaning we need more time to kill as much as we can, to destroy as much as we can, to eliminate as much targets as we can. Once we're done, then you guys can sit. So America single-handedly stood against such a charter. So it was used in a bad way by the American government, to say the least. And obviously, America had other supporters. So before we continue, let us take a break and we will come back, inshallah.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. And just before the break, we were looking at human rights and the Human Rights Charter and the United Nations. And we said that when Gaza was under siege and it was under heavy fire by the Israeli war machine, America denied the United Nations to gather and to have an emergency meeting to come to a resolution or at least to stop the fighting, but America denied because Israel itself, they said, well, we still have more work to do, we got more people to kill, therefore we're not going to give you the green light. So we say, well, instead of this Human Rights Charter being a way to save humanity and to save lives, in fact it became a charter to kill people. It became a way to give the oppressors more power to do what they want. So instead of fighting terrorism, they became the terrorists themselves. Instead of stopping in the face of those who are trying to take the right of others, they became the ones who support taking the right of others. So you can see that happens on a daily basis, for example, in weak nations, be it in the East or be it in the West, be it in Africa, Middle East, you name it. So, for example, when the people of Gaza and the people in Palestine, their lands were taken from them by force, the whole world stood and watched, and no one would care. When the Palestinians themselves, they intervened and they said, well, we will put a stop to it because we don't want people taking our right, they became the terrorists all of a sudden. So we get to say that we need a charter, a human rights charter that is universal. That's one, which means it needs to apply to everybody. We can't have it just applying to the people that we want. If America, for example, they themselves, or England, or Germany, or whatever, one of these superpowers, they want to use it for their advantage, they bring everybody in a blink of a second, they will issue a resolution, or they will issue a statement, and they will go to war, and they will do whatever they want, because it supports them. But if it's not, then they stand against it. So we say we need something universal that applies to all. And such a charter needs to be applied regardless of whether there are superpowers or not superpowers. It should apply to all. So the United Nations, in this instance that we mentioned, they should say, we don't care if you're America, we don't care if you're England, we don't care if you're China, we don't care how much power you have. It applies to all. And we will sit down and we'll discuss it and we'll try to come to a resolution and get a ceasefire and save the lives of innocent people. That's what should have been done. But as we see, that wasn't the case. It was on the contrary. It lasted over a week until Israel destroyed and killed hundreds of innocent of people, men, women, children, demolished houses, innocent people went. As a result, when all this was done and the rubble settled, then Israel said, okay, we're done. You guys can call a ceasefire now. We can call it a truce. And America and its allies were among those who were happy, and they weren't on the news saying, well, we managed to get somewhere and we ended the war. He did not end the war. He just killed a lot of innocent people. Your mission is finished, not that you saved anyone. So when we come to Islam, Islam says under no circumstances should you initiate war, should you take the rights of others, and use things for your own advantage and in return, take the right of those who are less privileged. Inshallah, we will continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.